Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Okay, folks, you are listening to the latest episode of Life on Planet Porky. Indeed, it is a pleasure to be recording. But Leslie Ann, welcome again to Landing on Planet Porky. Thank you very much indeed. Always good to see you. But I'm afraid that I've been laid low by the resurgence of this heat wave. I thought it had all gone. I thought that, you know, autumn was here.
What, you call this a heat wave?
God, heat wave to me. It's muggy. It's humid. The sun is beating down through my Velux windows as I speak into my office stroke studio. And, you know, I'm going to be struggling today.
Well, I thought this was quite cool, you know, very comfortable and nice autumnal early September weather. This is my favourite time of year.
Yeah, OK. Well, it's not my favourite time of year. My favourite time of year is when the leaves start coming down and we start moving from October to November. But I'm not sure any of us should be looking forward to an easy run to Christmas, because it looks like the world's collapsed again, doesn't it?
Well, it does. I'm not sure we'll even get Christmas this year, because anyone with more than 6 people in their family is stuffed, you know. Yeah. It's like drawing up a list for a wedding. Who are you going to leave out? Who are you going to invite? It's going to be very difficult. I think everybody just needs to harness their patience and trust that the government is being well advised and that they're doing the right thing.
Yeah, okay, that's great. That's the formal part of the podcast. Now,
have another drink.
Now, as I'm talking to you now, I have my usual batch of daily newspapers lined up on my desk in front of me. And as I go into the Times and look at their Friday art supplement, I see a very familiar face on the front. So once again, worldwide recognition in this time in the form of The Thunderer, probably the world's most famous newspaper, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones, author of Who Killed John Lennon. You've obviously been talking to the Times.
Well, they've been amazing. You know, the press have really rallied round. John has captured their imagination. I'm sure it's because these big anniversaries resonate. The numbers, you know, 50 years of the Beatles, 60 years since the Beatles in Hamburg, 40 years since John was assassinated, unbelievably. And he would have turned 80, of course, next month. So there are lots of reasons to focus back on his life and times, re-examine his music, and that's what I've been doing for the press.
Yeah, no, well done. There was something odd actually happened a couple of days ago. Ringo tweeted out and said, "Happy birthday, John."
He got the date wrong. He's a month early.
And I thought, oh, that had passed me by. But of course, I know it couldn't have passed me by because I talk to you on an almost daily basis. You know what I mean? But I retweeted it. And then, of course, a load of people say, "Hey, Porky, what's wrong with you? You know, what are you up to?" Now, also, I put out a picture the other day that appears in the inside back cover of your book. I know this because you did promise I'd get the first book that came off the presses, and I think I very nearly must have done, because it arrived through the post last Monday morning, ahead, I think, of most other people being able to get their hands on one.
Well, absolutely. Well, we always keep our promises, of course. But yes, that picture was in fact taken in the very doorway in Hamburg last summer, where Jörg Vollmer took pictures of John back in the early 60s. Yes. And one of those pictures made it onto the cover of the Rock and Roll album in the 70s.
Right.
So we managed to gain access to that building because it's a closed kind of collective place where essentially homeless people live, and they've made their living there and you can't actually gain access to it. But we did go with a guide who took us in and, of course, all stood in the doorway and had a picture taken. And when I was asked by the publisher for a portrait for the inside back cover.
Yeah.
That was the one I suggested we use, and went for it. They loved it.
Lovely. Well done. Great. Okay. Now then, what do you think about this ridiculous sort of row going on about whether women should be members of the Garrick Club? I don't know what the Garrick Club is. I've never been there. I know it's an elitist sort of male club where they will not admit women as members, but women can go there as guests and they can wine and dine and all that kind of stuff. And all this appears to have been sort of whipped up by Baroness Bra, Ms. Moan, who's a sort of lingerie business tycoon, who seems to have suddenly got very upset about it, even though it's been going on for about 170 years. Why does she want to be admitted to a club that doesn't want her sort there, so to speak?
Well, this has always been my argument. Why would you want to belong to a club that doesn't want you, that won't have you? You know, this argument raged, didn't it, in Elvino in Fleet Street way back when.
Yeah.
We weren't allowed as women to go to Elvino unless we were the guest of a man.
Yeah.
And if we were there, we couldn't go up to the bar and order drinks.
I know, isn't that ridiculous?
Look, there's plenty of other places to go.
Yeah.
I belong to two clubs. I belong to the Groucho Club, mm-hmm. famously, and to Soho House.
Yeah.
Worldwide, I can go to any Soho House around the world if I find myself in Chicago or LA or wherever, you know, because I'm an Every House member. But if they had a policy of not admitting women as members, I wouldn't bother to go. Find somewhere else.
Are you a member of any women's only clubs?
No, and I wouldn't be on principle.
No.
Because what's the point of segregation in this day and age?
Yeah.
Surely the whole idea is to all muck in together. You know, it's a different world now, 21st century, folks.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. And also, I wouldn't join the Garrick Club because I think that's incredibly discriminatory not to allow women. I mean, some men bore me stiff and I prefer the company of women. I mean, there are other men, which I have to say, I do enjoy their company very much. You know, if they're an old colleague from Fleet Street, it's great to get together for a couple of hours and sit there and, you know, have a couple of pints of beer and some wine and all that and talk about all the old, you know, exciting adventures we've been through and all that kind of stuff. But that's only because I've worked with them. It's not because they're male, you know what I mean? It's because we've got something in common. And if these guys, you know, want to start a little club where they only want themselves to be admitted, but what I can't get is that it's either an all-male club or it's not. And if you can allow women in anyway, then it's belittling to say to a woman, you can come here as my guest, you can't pay for a drink or you can't pay for a meal, but, you know, that's the power I have over you inside this building. I think you either say no women or all women, but I think it's a horrible sort of in-between, you know, look who's in charge here type scenario, which I frankly find very, you know, almost repulsive.
Oh, I agree. I have been to the Garrick. It's not all that, by the way.
Yeah.
It's not that impressive. The food wasn't very good. We had to share the table with, you know, they have these long refectory type tables in there, and you have to share with lots of people you don't know and so on.
Oh, I hate that. I hate that.
So what's the point?
Yeah.
The Arts Club is like that. The Chelsea Arts is the same.
Yeah, I can't.
And you can occasionally find yourself on a table with interesting folk. But if you've gone out to dinner with a friend or a colleague, it's because you want to talk to that person.
Yeah.
Not because you want to talk to everybody else.
No, I totally agree. There's a pub down the side of the River Thames on the walkway between sort of Blackfriars and Borough Market. I think it's called The Swan. And that's what they have in there. When you go there for lunch, one huge table down the middle of the sort of main hall. And I just said, this is before the pandemic and all that. So there was no danger of, you know, getting infected by anybody. But I don't want to sit at a long table with 20 other people on it. And that's why I, by the way, Leslie, and I used to hate those, whatever they used to call them, nouveau style cafes, you know, like restaurants, which look like cafes, you know, plain table, plain chairs and tables for 2-3 inches away from each other all the way down the outside wall. I hated all that.
Oh, yeah, there's another aspect to this, of course, which is the person you're talking to, you really ought to be facing, not sitting beside.
Yes, I agree.
So to be seated at tables like that defeats the object of being with your guest.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I like restaurants like that great one in Covent Garden
very near to one of the recording studios you and I used to use. Do you know what I'm talking about?
It's, in the good old days. Which one?
It's legendary. It's
it's so legendary we can't so think of its name.
I can never think
of it. What, you mean Joe Allen or somewhere?
No, Joe Allen. I haven't mentioned you, Joe Allen, yet. That's
Yeah, it's not as good as the old one. I mean, the food's the same. Yeah. Menu's the same. Yeah. Wine's the same. The staff are the same.
Yes.
But it's a much smaller venue. I used to love the fact that the old one was so spaced out.
Oh, I love it.
You know, the tables were not close together, so you weren't eavesdropping on other people's conversations. And they had big toilets. I went in the ladies there once and ran bang smack into a man dressed as a woman.
What?
And it really threw me because this was the new rule, wasn't it, that transgender folk could use the same toilets as the person they were emulating, let's say. But it did throw me. I didn't feel entirely comfortable.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. I wouldn't have felt entirely comfortable. No, I love Jarlands. If you wanted to hide away from people because you were dining with somebody you shouldn't have been, you could go to the table at the top end of the bar around the corner, so to speak, and hide there.
Oh, I know what you mean, yeah.
If you wanted to be public, you could have a table that literally faced the bar. And if you wanted to be, you know, in between the two, you've got a table behind the wall, so to speak, in the main body of the restaurant, you know. Oh, no, I love Jarlan. I love Jarlan.
It's not the same. I mean, go to the new one by all means, but you won't find it's like the old days.
No, you won't. No, the one I'm talking about is, remember we used to meet in that pub opposite the Covent Garden studio, right? And
oh, yeah, I do. Maiden Lane.
Maiden Lane, absolutely right. You've got the name.
Can't think of the name of the pub.
And then you come out, the studios are opposite. You turn right, and it is one of London's most famous restaurants. And I was taken there once by Bernard Ingham, believe it or not. Bernard Ingham was Mrs. Thatcher's...
you mean Rules.
Rules, absolutely. You got it, absolutely. Rules. In fact, we've got to go there sometime because I think that is a beautiful, elegant restaurant. Very expensive, obviously. But I used to, you know, I've only been there about half a dozen times in my life, but I always felt there was something special going on when I was there, you know?
I tell you where I went yesterday was Scott's with my editor from the publishing house. We had an epic 5-hour lunch. When did you last do a 5-hour lunch?
No, a long, long time ago, I have to say.
Yeah, we went through the menu. We had everything. And we were pointing out, you know, there's the table that Nigella Lawson nearly got throttled by her ex-husband at.
That was outside, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was great fun. Yeah. Absolutely loved it.
Wow, I haven't had a 5-hour lunch for such a long time. I hope that
me neither.
The drink was taken, was it?
Yeah, quite a bit, yeah.
Yeah, it was good.
Yeah, we sort of staggered out into the sunset at about 6:30. It was lovely.
Excellent. Well done. That's brilliant. Now, of course, the world is a new place today. Millions of people shattered, distraught, don't know what they're going to do with the rest of their lives. At the news that the Kardashian family are never going to record one of their programmes ever again. I don't think I've ever watched a minute of it, but they have literally become a worldwide phenomenon, which runs into billions and billions of dollars. How did all that happen?
Who knows? I've never seen it, but I absolutely loved what Piers Morgan wrote yesterday about it when he called them a bunch of talentless, narcissistic, branded bimbos, brain-dead even bimbos, whose absurd antics have shown the world how not to behave.
Mm.
Yeah, I fully agree. I can't stand the sight of them.
But if you end up as a billionaire, then as far as I'm concerned, they've won and we've lost.
Is it only about money, Mike?
Well, a lot of it's about money. A lot of it's about money. I mean, I have a dire, you know, fear in life, a desperate fear of poverty. And that's one of the things that's always made me want to get up and go to work every day is that I don't fancy poverty. You know, we've all seen poverty in various parts of the world. I don't believe poverty is a huge problem in this country because we're a very wealthy country, a very well-developed welfare state. Nevertheless, I don't want to be at the bottom end of society. I want to be much higher up if possible. I mean, I've never attained, you know, multi-millionaire status like some of the people we've mixed with over the years, but I do want to feel comfortable. And therefore, I think that accumulating as much money as you possibly can is not a bad thing.
Yeah, well, you're an interesting person, Mike. Oh, you know, and you've lived a big life. You've been all over the world. Mm. You've met fascinating people. You have opinions and thoughts inside your head.
Mm.
However much money they've got, these Kardashians are not ever going to be interesting people.
Yeah, but does it matter? Because
well, it does to me. I don't want to hang out with them.
Well, no, but they don't want you to hang out with them either, because well, they're concerned. All they really need are millions of young girls around the world looking up to them, admiring them. Let me just read you these figures. Kim Kardashian West, age 39, personal fortune, $696 million. How about that? Right?
Yeah, well, I mean, she can keep it, really. Money doesn't make you happy, does it, really?
It makes me happy. Kylie Jenner, 23, $691 million. Isn't one of them a billionaire? Isn't the youngest one a billionaire? I can't even find it in this list here.
But... yeah, there was some talk about that, wasn't it? They don't interest me, I'm sorry. I'm not impressed by their fortune.
Yeah, well, golly, money does impress me, I have to say.
But they've taken all that money off all those gullible young girls, haven't they?
Well, have they?
Is that something to be proud of?
What? So some little girl somewhere spending £2 or £3 on a bit of... jewellery or some cosmetics, which have been promoted by the Kardashians, that's improved the little girl's life because she sees the Kardashians as heroines, as, you know, role models, as people who succeeded in life. And if she's got to spend £3 or £4, you know, acquiring a bit of the Kardashian, you know, allure, then that she likes it, doesn't she? She's not been taken advantage of, is she?
Well, if they're role models for the modern age, you know, I fear for global society. I really do.
So you would never let your daughters get dragged into it then?
No, and they're more discerning than that. You know, they wouldn't bother. They're not interested either.
Yeah. No, I know what you mean. Now, listen, talking about all that sort of thing and wealth and all that, are you aware of a guy called Tacky? And I mean, I don't mean he's tacky. I mean, that's his name. He's the boot guy.
Right. Is he the guy from Donkeys years ago who published a magazine called Red Mull and was a friend of John Lennon's?
I don't know if he was a friend of John Lennon's. He writes a column every week in Spectator. He's a good old age now. He's about 80.
But I think it is the same guy, yeah.
Yeah, it could well be. But
Greek origin.
Yeah, Greek origin.
That's him.
He has his own Greek island. Everything he's got, he inherited. He admits that. But he's been a socialite all his life, mixed with some of the most beautiful women in the world over the last sort of 60, 65 years. Tried to be a professional tennis player, but was never very good at it. But he was writing in a recent column about King Juan Carlos of Spain, who amazingly, and I'm sure you will have read this, paid his mistress €65 million from the Spanish economy just to keep her happy. But Tacky defends this, saying, well, hang on, he's a member of a European royal family. You know, you've got to have at least one mistress and you've got to keep that mistress happy. That's a strange sort of view in life, isn't it?
Well, this, of course, is what Prince Charles told Princess Diana when she found out about Camilla.
Amazing.
You know, that every Prince of Wales has always had a mistress, therefore I'm going to have one too. Mm. Imagine being a 19-year-old bride and hearing that from your husband.
Yeah. Well, I think if she'd been any older than 19, she might have walked out right away. You see what I mean? So I think that's probably the reason why he felt he could, because when you're 19, you've committed yourself to becoming the wife of the princess of the Prince of Wales, effectively the Princess of Wales. Even when your husband says that's you can't really walk out, can you?
Well, I mean, we know, don't we, that she probably knew about it the night before the wedding and that she tried to pull out, but all the courtiers told her that she mustn't.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Now, whilst I've been talking about how much I admire success and wealth to a certain extent and all that, am I the only person in this world who absolutely recoils now every time I see a magazine whose cover carries the judges from Britain's Got Talent? And I think they are Amanda Holden, David Walliams, Alicia Dixon, and of course, Simon Cowell. I see it on almost every publication for about the 3 or 4 weeks every new episode starts, and it's driving me absolutely mad. Is there not reader resistance to this? Will not people eventually say, oh no, not another picture of Amanda Holden, I'm not buying that?
I think the viewing figures have been falling steadily over the past few years.
Right.
And so they've upped the ante on the promotion and press, haven't they?
Yeah.
But I've got to agree with you, Amanda Holden gets on my tits. She's everywhere.
Gosh, yeah. Well, she's not only very successful on TV, and good luck to her, she's also very successful in radio. And as I work in radio myself, I was absolutely, you could have knocked me down with a feather when I read that her deal at her radio station, and I think it's, I got the radio station mixed up on our last podcast. I said it was Heart and it was somebody else, or it was somebody else and it was Heart. I can't remember now, but you know what I'm talking about. But she has a regular show on her radio station, which it is reported, for which it is reported she's paid £1.5 million a year for a 3 hour a day radio show. I think it's about 4 days a week. That is great money in the world of radio, believe me.
Now, how do they recoup that investment, do you think?
Well, that's a very good question. I don't know. You tell me.
Yeah, I've got no idea.
No, it's yeah. It wasn't a...
I must admit, I don't listen to her on the radio. I find her mildly annoying on television. She's very full of herself. I'm sure she's got her talents.
Yeah.
She keeps them well hidden, unlike her breasts, which seem to be on show the entire time.
That's a bit harsh again, isn't it, eh? Having a go at
little bit, yeah.
Young Amanda Holden. She keeps her talents well hidden. The point is, she's very successful. So whatever it is people pay her for, she's really cracked it, hasn't she? And got herself sorted, because she is, you know, one of the most famous people in this country. What really gets me, I've never watched really Britain's Got Talent much, but I do remember seeing a couple of the first sort of early episodes when I think Piers was a judge, okay? And I, you know, then it was almost like that one we used to watch as kids, Opportunity Knocks, you know what I mean? Some dreadful amateur staggers onto the stage, you know, carries out some appalling sort of, you know, singing or juggling or something like that. And then the judges just sort of, you know, give them a straightforward, well, that wasn't very good, or you're a genius or what. But now, apparently, according to people who do watch it, who I've spoken to, the actual contestant has to, at the end, sort of start crying and telling people about what a very bad deal they've had in life, and that they've got, you know, a sick mother, or they've been suffering depression, or, you know, they're battling with a transgender issue. And then all the judges start crying, you see what I mean? And it's become like this very weird show where the more sort of disturbed you are emotionally, the greater chance you've got of winning.
It is histrionic, and there is too much of that. Mm. And it's all very fake. You can see it coming. You know, I do watch it from time to time,
right,
sometimes with the kids for a laugh, and it's so predictable.
Yeah.
You know, the singers are never much good. The magic acts, you've seen them all before.
Really?
There's all the tugging of heartstrings.
Yeah.
You know, a little child comes on who lives with a foster mother and he dances a bit, and you think,
right,
oh, he's quite good. But
the
sob story is always better than the act.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. That's what I mean. The whatever they're supposed to be talented at, Britain's Got Talent, you're absolutely right. Whether they're a singer or a juggler, or whether they, you know, they're a mime artist or something like that, that's all irrelevant, because what they really get the marks for is how many members of the audience they can bring to tears at the end with a sob story.
Yeah.
I know that sounds like we're terribly heartless and all that, but I wonder how long these things will go on, you know. You can't.
Yeah, we're not falling for it anymore.
Well, I think you could be right. I mean, Simon Cowell, a hugely successful man, very, very talented and all that. He's had to have a shake-up of his empire recently, hasn't he? Because I think does he do the X Factor as well?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And I think
But he's fallen off his electric scooter, and he's not around at the moment, so they're having to do without him.
Yeah.
And I think this could be the crux for these shows, because love him or hate him, these shows are about Simon Cowell.
Yes, you're absolutely right. It is very odd, isn't it, for the guy who put it all together to then actually star right in the forefront of the production. Because doesn't that surely, we've all had this situation when we've worked in newspaper offices about how much or to what extent you think you can argue with your bosses and all that kind of stuff. I mean, if they're all sitting on the judging panel, and he is such a giant within the, not just the industry, but in the putting together of this show, can you really argue with him and expect there to be no repercussions?
Well, no, because he calls the shots. But two things I have found lately very, very intensely annoying.
Right.
One was when he started to bring his little boy, Eric, onto the X Factor.
Oh, yeah.
And he'd sort of always be there in the audience. And once there was even an act who apparently had been signed by this kid, Eric, to a record label that he owned. Mm. And this little boy was about 5 at the time.
Yeah.
So there's that. And the other thing is the constant irritating flirtation of David Walliams towards Simon Cowell. I find that horribly inappropriate.
Yeah, we talked about Walliams, didn't we, the other day, and he's got all these books out on all that now. But I don't know, you know, I agree with you. I kind of don't get it anymore. I got him in Little Britain. I don't get him anymore. Look, talking about stars like that and moving from sort of Amanda Holden to more serious journalism. Now, there's a lady who I think she hosts. That's just my machine making another noise. I know you've taught me how to get rid of it, Leslie Amber.
You don't listen.
No, I don't listen. Her name is Naga Monchetti, and she is a regular fixture on BBC Breakfast, you know, and she's, you know, very professional, and she's a BBC stalwart and all that, does it with another guy whose name I can't remember. But she's been told now, because the BBC is going through a very interesting sort of phase. They've got a new boss called Tim Davey, and he appears to be sort of trying to immediately clamp down on what he sees as political bias within the organisation. But And she is, you know, like most of the people who work on the BBC, leans towards the left. That's obvious. And I'm not criticising her for that. It seems to be a culture at the BBC. But she's been told now that it's, you know, it's a conflict of interest to host a BBC show and then go and accept a £10,000 fee to host a private do at places like Aston Martin or the NatWest Bank. Because what happens then when a story comes up, which they've got to talk about maybe Aston Martin having financial problems, or did NatWest, you know, not act properly with issuing mortgages or something like that. It's completely inappropriate, isn't it?
It is. And whatever happened to impartiality?
Yeah.
You know, in the real world, we would not be allowed to compromise ourselves in that way.
Yeah.
So we'd be called out for that.
Yeah.
And I think that, yes, there is a point here. As a BBC presenter, you need to be impartial and not to take the shilling of those looking to exploit your BBC connection.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. Okay, folks, I want to introduce you all to Packed Coffee. What is Packed Coffee, you are asking, I'm sure? Well, it's flexible coffee plans delivered to your door. Yes, that's right, to your very front door. Now, it's all about coffee without compromise. That means we only source the best coffee. And Packed promises to pay farmers between 25% and 125% over fair trade rates. And the coffee that arrives at your door is always freshly roasted.
Now tell me, Mr. Parry, why is Packed Coffee rated so highly?
Well, the reason is, and I'm glad you've asked, it's that it's freshly roasted. It's specialty coffee. Packed does not sacrifice quality for the sake of profit, okay? Let's make that absolutely clear. It's 100% specialty grade, quality checked over and over, roasted fresh from your order and ground just moments before it is shipped. There's so much variety, over 15 different rotating coffees at any one time to choose from, and Packed sources from more than 8 different origins. One of the great things about the Packed experience is the sheer flexibility. You can select exactly how you want your coffee and when it's delivered to you. It's not a rigidly formatted subscription service. You can get coffee whenever you want it, and you can pause, cancel, or change your plan at any time online. Free and fast delivery, no hidden postage charges, and if you order before 1 p.m. Monday to Friday, your order will be with you the very next day. And Packed or letterbox friendly. You don't need to be home. It lands on the doormat.
So, Mr. Parry, when did you last have a cup of Packed coffee, and what plan did you put together?
Well, I'm so glad you asked me that, Leslie, because I have one in my hand right now, okay? I have my own personal plan. What I've got here is Planalto, okay? Fantastic coffee. I'm just going to open the bag it came out of. Oh, the aroma, honestly, is absolutely gorgeous, okay? It's a Brazilian coffee. It has hints of chocolate malt milkshake, okay? It's grown by Sergio Montavanini, okay? It even tells you that. That's how personal this coffee is to your taste, okay? It's brilliant. I love it. It tastes fantastic. And this has resulted in the cup of coffee I have in my hand now. Absolutely wonderful. I can really remember enjoying a cup of coffee so much. You can choose from beans or pods, ground or whole bean, depending on how you like to brew it. And you have the choice of several different coffees, okay? So today, we really want you to try this delicious coffee, and we'll give you a discount code for you to get your first bag from £1.95. And that code, the discount code, is Porky, P-O-R-K-Y. So you go to PactCoffee.com, that's PactCoffee.com, create your flexible coffee plan, enter the code PORKY, P-O-R-K-Y, at checkout, and get specialty coffee through your letterbox. Don't wait. Go to PactCoffee.com and create your own coffee plan.
Code is valid when you create a Pact coffee plan for new customers only.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Okay, folks, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Planet Porky today. And I have to say, Leslie Ann, you know, I've got 3 or 4 days to get through. I've mentioned this already on this podcast. 3 or 4 days of heat. The heat does get me. You don't understand how it gets me. It makes me feel breathless. My skin gets rashes and all that kind of stuff. I have to become a bit of a hermit. But, you know, as always, I will battle through.
So you just need to go a little slower, Mike, and keep your fluid intake up.
I'll keep the fluid intake up. Don't worry about
that. A bit of vitamin C in the mornings, yeah. And just take deep breaths and just keep calm and carry on.
Yeah, well, you may well be right. Certainly a glass of wine or two was taken by yourself yesterday.
Were you following me again?
No, I wasn't following you. You've already admitted on this.
What, is it illegal now?
Wine, no, but, you know, it's excess. And I thought that you moderated your excesses, Miss Jones.
I mean, can I tell you, it was only 2 glasses of champagne and 1 bottle of wine between 2 of us.
My God. And it took you 5 hours to get rid of all that. Slowing down since the days we used to spend all night in the Harrow. But anyway, there we are.
Yeah, well, we're not young anymore.
But anyway, I've got good news for you, because it's if you always seem to have a wine bottle or two in your shopping basket, perhaps you shouldn't feel too guilty. Research shows that those who regularly buy it and rarely purchase cola, juice and squash tend to be less likely to snack on unhealthy food. A study found only 21% of wine drinkers are overweight or obese, compared to 30.6% of sugary drink fans and 27% of those who mainly buy water. So there you go. Wine is very good for you.
Of course it is. I mean, what would you rather have, a glass of wine or a bar of chocolate?
Who, me?
Yeah.
Well, a glass of wine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a no-brainer, isn't it? I don't think that wine gives you a sweet tooth. Anything that gives you a sweet tooth, such as Coke, lemonade, all of that stuff.
Yeah.
Lucozade is my weakness, I have to say. And I really ration myself on that. But ever since I was a child, whenever you were sick and off school, which obviously wasn't very often, but my mum would always go and buy me a bottle of Lucozade.
Yeah.
And in those days, it came with that. Do you remember that dark yellow cellophane around the outside of the bottle? I used to save that. I used to get her to iron it.
Yeah.
And then come Christmas time, I'd make stained glass windows with it and things. Oh. That's how sad I was.
Very creative.
Yeah, but Lucozade, I mean, there's something about it. And it was a fantastic hangover cure.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what I like these days, and I sometimes just have a glass of it in the mornings when I want to perk myself up, is Andrew's Liver Salts.
Oh, God. That's going back a bit. My grandmother used to use that.
Yeah, I know. Well, they're not called Andrew's Liver Salts anymore. They're just called Andrew's Salts, OK? But you can still get them in chemists. And it's like, do you remember Alka-Seltzer?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's like an Alka-Seltzer tablet, but it's in powder form. And I have to say, I've had a few drinks the night before. And the other thing is, it's great for your digestion as well. You know what I mean? So I'm into the old Andrew's Salts all the time. Tell me, during the course of your career, you have associated with and got to know many, many people in the music and record business. Did you ever come into touch with, and do you know David Hamilton? Diddy David is 82.
He's actually a friend of mine. I've done quite a bit with David over the years.
Right.
And when I was doing my second Freddie Mercury book, I interviewed him for that because, you know, everybody said that Kenny Everett broke Bohemian Rhapsody on Capital Radio by playing the acetate of the disc. It wasn't even out yet.
Yes.
14 times over a weekend.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, Capital Radio has only ever been a London station.
Yeah.
It was David Hamilton who broke that record on his record of the week and played it every single day. And that, of course, was a national show on BBC Radio 1.
Right.
So Kenny Everett took the credit for years that Diddy David Hamilton actually deserved.
That's so interesting, that, because I thought Queen were actually very well established even before Bohemian Rhapsody came out. And I mean, I know that's their signature tune now and all that, but why wasn't that played nationally anyway? It was a new Queen record. So surely it should have been played everywhere anyway, shouldn't it?
Well, they weren't huge until that point. And also the record was more than 6 minutes long. And in those days, you know, there was a policy of playing discs that were about 3 minutes long, 2 to 3 minutes long.
Yeah.
So it was always considered too long for a playlist.
Yeah.
So it did break barriers. It was unprecedented. Very few singles. I'm trying to think of a couple more. American Pie, but of course that wasn't recorded as one single. It was in two parts.
Right.
It was the record company who put Don McLean's record out as a single.
Right.
And then there was Richard Harris, MacArthur Park.
Yeah.
Well, that was another long one, but they're quite rare.
Yeah, but the most famous one, and you will know this, of course, better than me, was Hey Jude, because, you know, the opening bars of Hey Jude still send a shiver down my spine, particularly when you see that video of them playing it on the David Frost Show. Well, I think it's the first time they ever played it, Sunday night on the David Frost Show. And ladies and gentlemen, let me bring you The Beatles. And then Paul McCartney, you know, is seen, the cherubic face of Paul McCartney over the piano and bang and all that. So anyway, as I read it somewhere, because I read everything about the Beatles like you do, when Lennon was then back at the Apple offices, he said to somebody, it might have been George Martin, might have been somebody else, he said, "That's great, that record's 9 minutes long." And somebody said, "Yeah, well, the problem is, you know, nobody will play that, it's too long." And Lennon looked at him and said, "Oh, no, they will for us." And of course they did, didn't they?
They did. I think a lot of the time the presenters faded it out.
Yeah.
So you didn't get the full kind of na-na-na-na-na-na-na's on the end.
Yeah.
You kind of knew where it was going by then, didn't you?
Yeah, no, I take that. And this recording I'm telling you about that I saw, that happened in a studio where the audience then came in and surrounded all the Beatles. You know, surrounded.
They did. It was chaos, wasn't it?
Yeah, surrounded Lennon. He was seemed to be sitting on a shelf somewhere, you know, on the side or something like that. It was absolutely terrific. Do you ever have any dealings, or have you had in the past, with Guy Ritchie, the film director?
Never actually met him, although I think you've shared a pub with him, haven't you?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, he's got a pub around Fitzrovia somewhere, and we saw him there. No, but I was, you know, I check these things out every day. I was surprised to find that Guy Ritchie is only 56, and I thought he'd been around much longer than that because, of course, he married Madonna, didn't he?
Yeah, he's quite a bit younger than her. I think she's in her early 60s, maybe about 61, 62.
Yeah.
Well, he's quite baby-faced, wasn't he?
Yeah. I mean, he made Lock, Stock and...
Two Smoking Barrels.
Which Vinnie Jones was in. And then I think that was, like, the only thing he made until many years later when he made Sherlock Holmes or something. But anyway, I'm not sure. I'm not a great film buff. But nevertheless, if you're going to marry and then, it's only your first marriage and you're pretty sure it will be because it should be if you marry Madonna, then you should marry somebody like Madonna, who then, out of the settlement, when the marriage breaks up, you get a £9 million estate in Wiltshire, yeah?
Well, it's not bad, is it? And he swiftly married someone new, didn't he? He has a whole new family now.
Yeah.
And poor old Madonna is still sort of hanging around with 26-year-old boys, which seems a little undignified to me, especially when you've got kids about the same age.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. But, I mean, I don't know how you work that out. That's the lifelong problem, isn't it, of an elderly man with a younger woman perfectly acceptable in society, an elderly woman with a younger man perfectly unacceptable in society. You know what I mean? It's always been that way. Talking about older people, I've been reading the serialisation of a book written by Barbara Amiel.
Amiel,
is it? Yeah.
Barbara Amiel. Yeah, Conrad Black's wife, isn't it?
Utterly brilliant, honestly.
Well, Liz Hodgkinson was online last night saying, and she obviously is a contemporary of Barbara's.
Yeah.
She said, "I think everybody needs to take all of this with a massive dose of salt."
Really?
In other words, this is all exaggeration and made up. you got to read between the lines. It's, yes, it's a fabulous tale of sex and spite and high society and all the rest.
Yeah.
But really, I mean, come on. Mm. I think a lot of the people she's written about are dead, so she can't libel anybody.
Right.
But she's gone for it. She's decided, you know, I'm going to write my memoirs and I'm going to kill the competition.
Yeah. Well, it's just so fascinating, you know, the world in which she lived in. I read a previous story about her. Apparently, she was ultra attractive. I mean, mega attractive, this lady. She's 80 now and still looks very good. I hate to ever sound ageist about women, but obviously women look better when they're 30 than they do when they're 80. You know what I mean? But apparently, I mean, she was absolutely bombshell brunette beautiful. You know, and men were crawling over themselves to, you know, to wine and dine her and romance her and all that kind of stuff. I even read that one guy who romanced her, apparently she had quite a magnificent bust, okay?
Well, as my father used to call it, a significant bazoom.
A significant bazoom, a great way for Mr. Ken Jones, the legendary sports writer, to describe it. And apparently the weight of this magnificent bust used to get to her. So she used to wear, like, foam padding cushions underneath the strap of a bra on her shoulders, right? And one boyfriend admitted that he stole those ones from a bedroom they were in, and he has them framed, and they're his prized possession. I mean, that is very odd, isn't it?
I can think of more interesting things to steal. Well, I mean, exactly. Bits of foam rubber. I mean, it's the kind of thing you'd get on the back of a bicycle or something.
Yeah, well, exactly.
Mind you.
Yeah.
Yeah, we better not go there. Where do you park your bike?
You know, being a bit funny about other women again, you know.
No. I'll keep it down.
But anyway, look, the reason why I read the series she wrote, and I mean, talk about, if we believe it, and I like to believe it because it's such a great story, but if we talk about one of the greatest falls from fame to penury of all time, it was when Conrad Black, who owned the Daily Telegraph and the Sunday Telegraph and the Spectator magazine, was suddenly indicted for allegedly, because he's still challenging these charges, allegedly embezzling money from his own company, Hollinger, right? So this all arises in American court. He eventually gets sentenced to 6.5 years in jail in a top security jail in Florida. Meanwhile, Barbara is living in Canada because she's Canadian, so is Conrad Black, and that's the only place where they still had a home because all their money had been frozen, £20 million worth of assets, and she was having to fly down to Florida and queue up with all sorts of people just to get 20 minutes with her husband after travelling, you know, 1,500 miles. And like, it's an amazing story of the fall from grace. But I do remember years ago reading about her when she said, something like, the quote was something like, "My extravagance is absolutely endless," when she was showing somebody around their London house and a room, you know, in which she had 600 pairs of shoes. You know what I mean? And you kind of think that if people go out on a limb like that to boast about their kind of wealth and their extravagance, they've got a fall coming somewhere.
Yeah, they get what's coming to them, don't they? But to give her her due, she stayed faithful. Well,
absolutely.
She remained with Conrad Black.
Absolutely.
Let's put it that way. I read too
Come on, that's a bit harsh as well.
No. Don't misunderstand me.
Yeah.
I read that he might return to the Lords. Is that true?
Well, I think it's a possibility. I think it depends what happens in the ongoing sort of legal situation, you know. But in that interview I'm telling you about, there was such an interesting piece. So what happened was, you know, they lived in, you know, the townhouse in Belgravia or something like that, and they're dining at somebody else's house in somewhere like, oh, I don't know, you know, Kensington or something like that. And they're due to go back to America and there's that afternoon. And there's another couple at this lunch party who are also going back. And the other couple at the lunch party, Barbara Emile, says to them something like, "I don't suppose you'd be on our plane, would you? You know, we're going first class BA." And they said, "No, we're not on your plane because it's our plane." And she got terribly upset, according to this report, that she'd humiliated herself by revealing in this lunch party that they didn't have their own private plane to fly back to America. And then threw a tantrum and wanted to know from Conrad, "Why are we only going first class on a British Airways plane?" I mean, you know, it's a different world, isn't it?
How the other half lives.
But anyway, after the three-part serialisation, I then read a piece from her, and it was then interviewing her, because obviously she's promoting her book, And listen to this. This is, you know, everything about headlines in newspapers. This is written by Jan Muir.
Okay. Oh, Jan Muir's piece in the Daily Mail, yeah.
Which says, hers is the memoir of the year that's left friends and enemies agog. Now read an interview with jail tycoon's wife, Barbara Amil. So frank and funny, you'll never look at whipped cream the same way again. And then the headline says, I just love sex. I once counted the number of partners I'd had. Don't even ask. Well, I'm sorry. I know it all happened before she married Conrad Black, presumably. But blimey, if my wife was going around making claims like that, she wouldn't be my wife again, believe me.
Now, come on, that is double standards, Michael. I mean, you've always boasted about the number of shags you've had in your life.
No, I haven't. I don't. I've never done it. That's ungentlemanly. Not at all.
Well, OK, I must have been talking to someone else.
No, I've told tales about them when people have asked me.
Well, what else do you call it?
Well, but I don't go round giving newspaper interviews saying, by the way...
No, well, that's true. No, you don't do that.
I was a Fleet Street mega shagger and all.
No, but that's double standards, because as a Fleet Street editor, you would happily buy that expose from Barbara Amil.
Yes, I would.
But you wouldn't talk about your own private life.
No, I wouldn't. No, I agree.
Well, that's double standards.
I don't think it is. Some people talk about that private life. And in fact, funny enough, I had a colleague in Fleet Street who was a mega shagger. I don't know why. He honestly wasn't very good looking, but he fancied himself terribly. And he was terribly confident with women and used to pick on women that, you know, he thought were having a problem or something like that. And he actually used to call himself, believe it or not, the Mick Jagger of Fleet Street.
The Jagger Shagger,
that's right, yeah. And, I mean, the problem was that the sort of lady he was meeting, we're not the journalists or anything, they were usually, I don't know, you know, sort of barmaids or something like that, you know. But anyway, each man to his own. Talking about Ms. Amil and her total...
Amil,
thank you. I can never pronounce these names properly. And her general distress that... you know, Lord Black didn't have a private plane and they weren't flying back to America in a private plane, humiliated over a lunch party because she had to admit they're only flying BA first class. Have you flown BA first class?
Yeah, loads of times.
Oh, what do you mean loads of times? Oh, that's great. I was going to tell you about the one time I did.
Yeah, well, I mean, there was a point when, you know, I was flying maybe more than you because of we didn't have the internet yet and we had to go everywhere to get the interviews.
Yeah, and how did you get into first class?
I usually got quite good at chatting up the women on the desk when they were checking you into club.
Wow, yeah. So...
And also, what's his name? The columnist on the Daily Mail, Nigel Dempster.
Okay.
So a few times we found ourselves on the same aircraft or about to board. Yeah. And if I didn't manage to get myself upgraded, he was always in first class. Mm. And once the plane had taken off, he would send a stewardess back to club class to say, Mr. Dempster is inviting you to join him. And then I'd sit and have lunch with him in first class and then I wouldn't have to go back. And then he would have a chauffeur-driven limo waiting for him on the tarmac.
On the tarmac?
On the tarmac.
What, JFK?
Yeah.
Good God. And was that all in his contract with the Daily
Mail? Absolutely. And he always stayed at the New York Racquet Club.
Right, yeah.
You know, right on Central Park there.
Yeah, yeah.
And we had a jolly good few lunches on the Daily Mail in those days.
I bet you did. God, blimey. I mean, I know that, you know, journalists could demand all sorts of huge bonuses. Jean Rook, for instance, was the only person on the Daily Express when she was entitled the First Lady of Fleet Street. She was the only person who had a Jaguar apart from the editor. At least the editor had a chauffeur-driven Jaguar, which, by the way, I don't think they get these days, do they?
They don't get anything. When I worked for the Sunday Express for Martin Townsend, he was getting the tube in to work.
God, really? Well, there was one complete idiot who I think started it all, right? I worked with a guy on the Daily Express, and not naming any names, bright young man, very ambitious. I think he became an education correspondent, worked his way up and all that, and eventually ended up as the editor of the Sunday Telegraph, right? And... you know, being all sort of right on and all that kind of stuff, he thought he was making a hero of himself by going in to see the chief executive, you know, as he was being appointed and said, look, I'll do a deal with you. He said, I'm a bit of a cyclist. He said, I live in, you know, sort of Islington or somewhere like that. And I intend to cycle in most mornings. And that means that I'd be prepared to trade in my chauffeur-driven Jaguar for an extra reporter on my staff on the Sunday Telegraph. And of course, this chief executive said, yes, that's a marvellous idea. Yeah, we can come to that arrangement. What happened in the next round of talks? They made that post redundant. So he lost his extra reporter and he lost his chauffeur-driven Jaguar. And then other proprietors, certainly in the Telegraph group, you know, started thinking about, well, if he doesn't need a chauffeur-driven Jag, why does anybody else? So, you know, but they were just treated like that. But getting back to Nigel, I liked Nigel a lot. A lot of people didn't have a lot of time for him, thought he was a snob and all that kind of stuff. But we used to meet at Epsom every year for the Epsom Derby. And I found him absolutely delightful company.
He was a wonderful person. He had that rare gift of, you know, he would expose all the secrets of the aristocracy and celebrities in his column, but he managed to remain friends with them.
Yeah.
And that is a bit of a gift, isn't it? Not very many journalists have that quality.
No, I totally agree. I always thought he was good company and always open. He wasn't, you know, he wasn't snobbish. He was a huge star in Fleet Street. Let's remind people, he was the original Fleet Street diarist, wasn't he? The greatest of all, you know.
And he was immaculate. He always looked like he'd just come out of a barber's shop. You know, his clothes were perfect. Yeah. Everything was coordinated.
I agree.
Do you remember the braces and the white collars and the cufflinks and all of that?
Yes, I do. And honestly, he could have been the star of a TV series, couldn't he? His own TV series. I didn't meet many people in that round of social gatherings and all that. It was way above my level, and I didn't really want to know them because I didn't like people like that. But I met one time a guy called the Seducer of the Valleys, Di Llewellyn, right?
Who was
a repulsive individual. I mean, you know, a pompous, overblown, useless, talentless waste of space who was only on Earth and in London because his father was a baronet who'd been an Olympic sort of show jumping champion or something. He was, in fact, the brother of Roddy Llewellyn, who romanced Princess Margaret. But what a tosser, honestly.
Well, I heard they both did.
Oh, did they? Oh,
really? I'm not sure whether at the same time.
Oh, I see, yeah. Well, I think they're all dead now, so just like Miss Emile.
Emile,
we can talk about him.
Do you remember the other one, Bungalow Bill?
Yes, I do, yes, the man of Kent. He was from Kent, yeah, I remember him, yeah.
Joan Collins's boyfriend, because we had a reporter on the Mail showbiz desk,
right,
whose name was Pat Hill. Yeah, so they looked a bit similar. Yeah, so we used to call Pat Hill Bungalow Hill.
Bungalow Hill, I love it.
Yeah, nicknames were all the rage, weren't they?
Of course they were. Bungalow Bill, it was alleged, was called Bungalow Bill because he had not much up top but lots below. And that's why we called him Bungalow Bill.
And I think that's why we called Pat Bungalow Hill.
Probably, yeah. I totally agree with it. Talking about Joan Collins, by the way, that wedges nicely into the story I was going to tell you about my first-class flight. It was back from Los Angeles, and as I got on the plane, the guy who was the head steward, chief steward, had his clipboard in his hand. He said, oh, it's you. And I said, yeah. And I had a club-class seat booked, you know. He said, oh, blimey. He said, me and the wife, she was also on the plane. She also worked for British Airways cabin staff. She said, oh, we're the biggest fans of your radio show and all that. Guess what? Joan Collins hasn't turned up. You can have her seat. So I had Joan Collins' seat in first class. Marvellous.
Well, there is a claim to fame.
Yeah, absolutely. And the greatest joy, of course, was when they brought the menus round. I said, OK, what time are you serving dinner? And, of course, they said, whenever you want it. That was
brilliant.
In first class. You could just have it whenever you wanted it. So that was terrific. Right. OK, Miss Jones. Well, thank you very much indeed for joining me today. I've now got to put up with another 2 or 3 days of outrageous heat, and then hopefully autumn will click in. And once again, great to see your book being publicised in the Times this morning. And you'll be joining me on my talk radio show, I think, in a week or so's time to tell us more about it, yeah?
Yeah, I'm so looking forward to that. Thank you in advance for having me.
Well, it'll be great to have you there. Thank you very much. And to everybody else, thank you for joining us today. Until next time, take it easy in the heat, folks.
I must admit, I don't listen to her on the radio. I find her mildly annoying on television. She's very full of herself. I'm sure she's got her talents.
Yeah.
She keeps them well hidden, unlike her breasts, which seem to be on show the entire time.
That's a bit harsh again, isn't it, eh? Having a go at
a little bit, yeah.
Young Amanda Holden. I didn't meet many people in that round of social gatherings and all that. It was way above my level, and I didn't really want to know them because I didn't like people like that. But I met one time a guy called the Seducer of the Valleys, Di Llewellyn, right?
Who
was a repulsive individual. I mean, you know, a pompous, overblown, useless, talentless waste of space who was only on Earth and in London because his father was a baronet who'd been an Olympic sort of show jumping champion or something. He was in fact the brother of Roddy Llewellyn, who romanced Princess Margaret. But what a tosser, honestly.
Well, I heard they both did.
Oh, did they? Oh,
I'm not sure they were at the same time.
Oh, I see, yeah. Well, I think they're all dead now. They're just like Miss Emil.
Emil,
we can talk about.
Money doesn't make you happy, does it, really?
It makes me happy.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.